It was game two of the 1978 World Series. The Dodgers versus the Yankees. The Dodgers had a 4-3 lead with two outs in the ninth inning. Looking to go up 2-0 in the series. But there were significant problems with closing out the game. First of all, there were two men on base. A hit by the next batter would likely bring in the tying run and possibly the winning run. But the more pertinent issue was the man striding confidently to the plate, Reggie Jackson. Jackson had made fools of the Dodger pitching in the previous World Series, going so far as to hit 3 home runs in one game. A black day indeed. He seemed destined to show once again that he was Mr. October. This became all the more likely when Dodger manager Tommy Lasorda trundled out to the mound to take out the pitcher. Because the reliever that he signaled for was a rookie by the name of Bob Welch. Jackson had destroyed the veteran Dodger hurlers. What could someone with little experience in the majors do? I can still see Welch coming in from the bullpen and taking the ball. He looked like he was 13 years old. He was a lamb led to the slaughter. Reggie took a massive cut at Welch's first offering and came up empty. The second pitch was a heater high and tight, sending Jackson spinning from the batter's box. He glared at Welch and dug back in. Eventually, the count went to 3-2, raising the drama to its highest possible peak. The crowd was on its feet, urging on the rookie to one final effort. Welch reared back and fired a blazing fastball over the plate, and Jackson corkscrewed into the ground as he flailed and missed. There was no joy in Mudville. Mighty Reggie had struck out. Welch would go on to be a star for many years, but what fans will always remember is his celebration with his teammates on the mound while Jackson cursed his way back to the dugout. In typical fashion, Reggie later whined to the press that he'd been distracted by the runner going from first base, as if that were a strange thing, considering that he was the winning run with that count and those number of outs. You would always expect that that runner would be going. Well, I've read that since leaving baseball, Jackson has become a believer in Jesus. I hope that is true and that we will have the opportunity to reminisce one day. But that confrontation came to my mind as I considered the words of Zophar in tonight's passage. Eliphaz and Bildad have each taken a swing at what Job has been offering in terms of his struggle with his devastating trial. Each of them thought that he had hit a home run with his counsel when in fact he had not even made contact. Now Zophar strides to the plate full of confidence. He might be last up in this inning, but he was ready to show just how this was done. Zophar will take a hack at Job's fastball tonight and miss by about 2 feet. He has the same flaw in his swing that the others have displayed. This is the third man to try to school Job, and the call from the divine umpire is 3 strikes and you're all out. These guys should have trailed back to the dugout and headed for the shower. But sadly, they will hang around for more plate appearances. The box score is going to look very ugly before this game is through. And I don't think that we are going to watch nearly all of it. I think we will have to fast forward. You know, we've got this, I think, on TiVo, and we're going to fast forward through some of the future innings here. It's going to get a little repetitive, but we need to see Zofar's inept at bat tonight. So let's begin in chapter 11 with Zofar's contribution to this ongoing debate. He has two main points to make about Job. First, he was a fool. Second, he was wicked. That sounds promising. So let's see how the first idea was expressed in verses 1 through 12. Joel has read those for us rather wonderfully, and we won't read them through again. But as with the others before him, Zophar cannot believe what he is hearing. He's outraged. This talk about wanting to go right from the womb to the tomb, which if you'll remember, that's what he was talking about. We've got this out of order, remember, so we're going back here to pick up this passage. That talk just cannot be borne. This mocking of God cried out for a rebuke, and he was just the man to deliver it. If Job thought that all this verbosity was going to confuse him or cow him into silence, Zophar would now happily correct that expectation. What sticks in Zophar's craw is what he states in verse 4. Job was still professing his righteousness despite all the evil that had come upon him. Job was saying that his viewpoint was the right one, even though he was the one that was in trouble. How impossibly stubborn was this? Of course, Job was right in his position that his sin had not brought on his trials, but Zophar would not even consider that any more than the other friends. Verses 5 and 6 are classic. Zophar prays that God would speak to this whole matter right now. As we're apt to do, he assumes that God would be weighing in on his side of the debate. You really want to be careful about, you know, invoking, you know, God's coming in and saying what the situation is when you might actually be in the wrong. He expects that God will open up his lips against Job. If he would just speak, it would all be clear. Job was the one with the problem. How shocking it will be to find that when God does speak, he's more opposed to Zophar than he is to Job. Zophar wants God to show Job the secrets of his wisdom. God's wisdom was doubled over, he says here. Has two sides is the way it reads in verse 6 in the NASB. The idea is being doubled over, something very thick. In other words, it's many-layered. It's difficult to penetrate what the meaning is. In this case, Zophar was sure that if, you know, the mystery of this could be explained by God, it would include the truth that Job had actually been punished far less harshly than he deserved. You'd find out that God forgets part of your iniquity. You'd find out that, you know, he's actually been very gracious considering all that you have been doing, that he only gave you this much. Kind of a hard thing to fathom, but that's what he's saying here. Rather than complaining against God and wishing that he, you know, had just gone straight to the grave after being born, and so Job should be on his knees thanking God for showing him this much mercy. That's how bad Job's actions had been. The irony of Zophar's words is that he is unwittingly not far off regarding Job. It is, well, let's ask the question. Is it true that Job does not know the secret plans of God here in this situation? That is true. He doesn't really know what's going on. He was not privy to the events in heaven that we've had described for us in the first two chapters. We're in the know. He did not know the secrets of God's wisdom here. Job should have pondered whether the Lord might have purposes here that were past finding out, that were good ones, but he just couldn't know them right now. There are secret things that belong only to the Lord. But the added aspect of the irony is that Zophar was further away from the wisdom of God than was Job. He not only did not know what God was doing, he was sure that he did know what God was doing, and he was way off. He thinks he has an easy target with Job. This is just slam dunk. This is obvious. I can just pour it on here because it's just so clear what's going on, and that I know I have the right scan on things. But his overconfidence is clearly showing here. Perhaps he can at least be forgiven the ignorant zeal of youth. It might be that he was younger, and so we can give him a little bit of a break for that. In verses 7 through 11, Zophar goes into another one of these descriptions of the wisdom and power of God for Job's benefit. We've had so many of these now, and they just keep going on. Don't you know who God is, Job? Let me tell you. Job had already demonstrated that he knew all of this. Job himself has said a lot about God's wisdom and power and so forth. This had to come across as condescending to Job in the worst sense of the term. Zophar concludes this part of his evaluation of Job with a helpful proverb. He apparently does not hold out much hope that his brilliant words will penetrate and really get to Job. Job was talking like an idiot. Let's just put it out there. And there was as much of a possibility that he would come around to Zophar's wise perspective as a donkey would give birth to a man. It seems that on top of everything else, Job is being portrayed as a donkey. So, having called Job a fool, an idiot, a moron, Zophar goes on to address his future prospects. And they were not looking good, as you might imagine, because Job was not taking the proper steps for a sinner to reconcile with God. Verses 13 through 20. If you would direct your heart right and spread out your hand to him, if iniquity is in your hand, put it far away and do not let wickedness dwell in your tents. Then indeed you could lift up your face without moral defect, and you would be steadfast and not fear. For you would forget your trouble. As waters that have passed by, you would remember it. Your life would be brighter than noonday. Darkness would be like the morning. Then you would trust because there is hope, and you would look around and rest securely. You would lie down and none would disturb you, and many would entreat your favor. But the eye of the wicked will fail, and there will be no escape for them, and their hope is to breathe their last. Again, we have the same counsel as the others before Zophar. He mocks the teaching of Job in verse 4. Oh, you've said my teaching is pure and all of that. He mocks that, but the doctrine that he provides here is worse than anything that Job had been pushing. This is the inflexible sowing and reaping principle, part 3. Job had done wrong, and he'd brought on this situation. It's the only way to look at this. He needed to prostrate himself before God and seek his pardon for that. Whatever that was that he was holding out on him, that he wouldn't admit, he needed to just get down on his knees, confess it. He needed to forsake his sin and start pursuing righteousness, if he would just do this, all would be well. All would be well, Job. It's just so close. It's just in your power to just turn this whole thing around. This nightmare would soon be water under the bridge. Everything would start to go his way then. Blah, blah, blah. Yawn. Snore. I'm surprised that Job was even awake at the end of this. It's just so repetitive. Verse 20 has the parting shot. If Job stayed on his current path, well, he would get his wish. He would have nothing to look forward to but breathing his last. And with that, Zophar rests his case. I'm sure that he did that with the air of, you know, having delivered a flawless response. He'd shown Job to be a fool who would not listen to wisdom, and a wicked man who would not depart from his sin. All done in love, of course. All done with nothing but love in his heart for Job. But, you know, these things just, they needed to be said. He only wanted Job's best. But in terms of 1 Corinthians 13, I think that this had been the noisy gong performance of a lifetime. A virtuoso gonger. It's hard to imagine anything more unloving, more worthless in the context. And have you noticed that while Job takes up a lot of space struggling with what God is doing, trying to work through this, that the monologues of the friends are getting shorter? And we're glad for that. You know, we're glad that we don't have to read any more than what we have of their exhortations. But I think that there's a reason for this, why it seems to be getting shorter. The truth is that they don't have anything to say, you know, other than this guiding principle of sowing and reaping. They're just, you know, regrinding that and so forth. They're not getting anywhere else, trying to go anywhere else, thinking about other possibilities. They just keep saying the same thing. And Job has to be thinking, you know, I got it. You know, I get where you're all coming from. I understand your position very well now. And having heard from friend number three, now, how do you feel if you are Job? Okay, I've heard from everybody now. I mean, it's definitely one of those who needs enemies, right? I mean, you know, what worse things could have been said to him, even if it was by people who detested him? But these were friends. Talk about piling on. He has to wonder if there is anyone who has anything but criticism for him. And he'd really have to look around, I think, for a long time to find anybody, you know, who wasn't champing at the bit to criticize him. The story is told. Okay, what does that mean? When I start with the story is told, it means it's not true, right? The story is told of an old man who was traveling with his young grandson. He put his grandson on a donkey while he walked alongside. In the first village they passed through, the citizens grumbled that he was a fool for spoiling his grandson riding on the donkey. So he got on the donkey, and he had his grandson walk along. In the next village, everyone was mocking him for making his grandson do the work while he took his ease on the donkey. So he pulled his grandson up with him, and they both rode on to the next village. But when he arrived, he was accused of abusing the animal with such a heavy load. So, as they moved on to their destination, he had them both get off and walk alongside the animal. But when they arrived at the end of the journey, the onlookers criticized him for not using a perfectly healthy work animal. I mean, why was he keeping it and feeding it anyway? The old man determined that in the future he would carry both the donkey and the boy. Well, the point is, and I think you grasp it, that if you have a critical spirit, you will find something in another person to criticize. They won't be able to win. The three friends have been shown to have that spirit. There is nothing that Job can do other than give in to their wrong perspective that will satisfy them. May we be careful to evaluate our own helpfulness, our own motives in telling others what they are doing wrong. In chapter 12, we have Job's contradiction of Zophar, beginning with the contention that he did possess wisdom after all. First 12 verses of chapter 12. Then Job responded, "Truly then you are the people, and with you wisdom will die. But I have intelligence as well as you. I'm not inferior to you, and who does not know such things as these? I'm a joke to my friends. The one who called on God and he answered him. The just and blameless man is a joke. He was at ease, holds calamity in contempt, as prepared for those whose feet slipped. The tents of the destroyers prosper, and those who provoke God are secure, whom God brings into their power. But now ask the beasts and let them teach you, and the birds of the heaven and let them tell you, or speak to the earth and let it teach you, and let the fish of the sea declare to you, who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this, in whose hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind? Does not the ear test words as the palate tastes its food? Wisdom is with aged men, with long life is understanding." We have one of the better comebacks of all time, I think, in verse 2. Job sarcastically presents his friends as the repository of all wisdom. "You're the man, Zophar. Wow, you know, you nailed it. What will mankind do once you pass from the scene?" I mean, people just have to, you know, stumble around in a nightmare of ignorance. Because, you know, you've really got it. In verses 4 through 6, Job laments his own status in comparison to the way that they were presenting themselves and the way that they thought of themselves. While the friends were secure in their position as the ones trying to school Job, he was just a joke to them and to everyone else. We're going to see that. It wasn't just to these guys. Job remembered the day when he was the leading figure in this region. Respected. Walked closely with God. Knew his blessings. But everything had turned upside down. Now he has to put up with this from someone still wet behind the ears. He has to be lectured to by somebody who clearly didn't know what had gone on in Job's life, what he was talking about. He states that it's easy to point out the faults of those in distress when one is prospering. There's a truth to that, right? You know, when you're feeling like, you know, you're on top of your game, things are going well, you know, you've kind of got everything under control, then you're kind of looking to, hey, you know, I really need to try and help you who are not where I'm at. And in this case, one's inclined to think, well, you know, Job, you made your bed here. You know, you're just going to have to lie in it. We think our comfortable situation somehow gives us the higher moral ground. Even those who are against the true God, who don't relate themselves at all to Him as far as what they have, they take comfort from their better circumstances. That's just human nature. Things are going well for me. I think I'm in a position now to really start schooling other people. There are many thoughts about the translation and meaning of the last part of verse 6. It's probably better to take the side note of the New American Standard and understand along the lines of replacing God's power with one's own abilities and resources. This is the arrogance of the self-sufficient mentality. Well, this is the wisdom of Job in saying, this is where you're coming from. This is why you're acting this way with me. It's just because your circumstances are better than mine. That seems to show a greater discernment than anything his friends are offering. He is giving a warning here about overconfidence that is based on things that you cannot control. You think that you've brought yourself to this position of superiority. You're wrong. If the friends could only see it, Job was exhibit A, that we ought to take nothing for granted. That we don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. That we ought not to boast in ourselves, hold ourselves up as superior. Verses 7 through 12 are intriguing. Job points Zophar to the creation. It would teach this young man what was lacking from his perspective. He's saying, you know, it should be pretty obvious as you look at these various things that go on. Now, commentators have different views on what the beasts and the birds and the fish and so forth will tell us, what Job wanted them to be telling Zophar. Some think that it is the presence of calamity, even when there's no specific sin being punished. That, you know, we look about and we see, you know, things that go on, and we wouldn't say, well, it was because there was a sin, this specific sin that went on there, and that's why this happened. Others take the view that God's use of his power over life and death is mysterious. Pretty close. Verse 9 gives us the only instance of the name Yahweh being used in the poetry section of Job. It's the only time Yahweh shows up in all the main area of the poetry between the two ends. And that's interesting. I think for me, I would have expected Elohim here in the context of creation. Okay, normally you get that because Elohim is more the God of everyone kind of idea, the God who made everything. You would normally expect that, but Job is seemingly holding on to the covenant name of God even as he struggles with how God is treating him. There's no question about who is behind his circumstances. He knows exactly what's going on there. His own life was in God's hands. He's saying, doesn't all creation tell us this, that there's prosperity, but then calamity, and you can't really figure it out from the human perspective. The question for him was, why a God who had established such a wonderful relationship with him and had given him so much, why would God devastate him with no apparent cause for it? Why? Verses 11 and 12 finish off the affirmation that Job had the wisdom that Zophar thought he lacked. He certainly had enough to know that Job had to be off. I mean, Zophar had to be off in his thinking. There was more to this situation than this simple principle that he kept putting forward as the solution to everything. And then secondly, under this point, Job clarifies that he respected the greater wisdom of the Lord. Verses 13 through 25, with him are wisdom and might. To him belong counsel and understanding. Behold, he tears down and it cannot be rebuilt. He imprisons a man and there can be no release. Behold, he restrains the waters and they dry up, and he sends them out and they inundate the earth. With him are strength and sound wisdom. The misled and the misleader belong to him. It's kind of interesting. We'll come back to that. He makes counselors walk barefoot and makes fools of judges. He loosens the bond of kings and binds their loins with a girdle. He makes priests walk barefoot and overthrows the secure ones. He deprives the trusted ones of speech and takes away the discernment of the elders. That's kind of an interesting idea too. He pours contempt on nobles and loosens the belt of the strong. He reveals mysteries from the darkness and brings the deep darkness into light. He makes the nations great, then destroys them. He enlarges the nations, then leads them away. He deprives of intelligence the chiefs of the earth's people and makes them wander in a pathless waste. They grope in darkness with no light, and he makes them stagger like a drunken man. Well, Job makes it clear that no one is going to outdo him in seeing God as completely sovereign over everything. I mean, he sees him this much and goes him a lot more. I mean, he gets into areas here where even a lot of believers would start becoming uncomfortable that God would really do that. But he's saying, yes, Job saw better than any what God is able to do and what he actually does do. The Lord controls human activity. He controls the elements of his creation. He controls the understandings of men. He controls the history of whole nations. Some of the details, I think, are thought-provoking. Does Job have himself in mind in verse 14? Where he talks about he imprisons a man and there can be no release. We've had a lot of that kind of idea. I'm all hedged in. I've got no freedom. Is verse 15 a reference to the great flood? Maybe. But I think that for practical purposes, for us, something to kind of take with us as we kind of start to wrap things up here, it's what we read in like 16, 20, 24. I think that's most instructive and perhaps most challenging. We think of such matters as, you know, what we know and acting upon what we know, that's under our control. We get information, and of course we'd like to think we get good information, have good ideas, and we're wise, and whatever wisdom we have, we have a perfect ability to act upon that. But it is actually God who gives us whatever discernment we have. And he can cause us to act foolishly. You know, if that's his desire, if that's where we are spiritually, does God ever cause people to be deluded? To just think wrong, kind of almost insane things? Would God actually do that? You ladies, I think, are you in 2 Thessalonians 2? I think you're coming into this. Sorry to jump on that, but that dovetails so well with this. 2 Thessalonians 2, 8 through 12, if you've been preparing for this, then that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That is the one whose coming is in accord with activity of Satan, with all powers and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. And so far you're reading all that, it's like, yeah, you know, Satan and, you know, the evil forces, and they put stuff out, and, you know, and people want to believe in it and so forth. But 11 gets really interesting. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they will believe what is false. In order that they all may be judged, you did not believe the truth, but took pleasure in wickedness. That seems to be a rather clear statement of God's involvement in the ability of people to apprehend truth, in actually presenting them with something that they grab onto and, of course, display their own sinful nature by going after it. That's something that God actually does. The misled, we read, and the misleader both belong to the Lord. And he does with them as he wishes. And while we're connecting to the lady study this year, we can ask, what did the Lord do in Daniel chapter 4 along these lines? Did he cause somebody to go bonkers, essentially? Yes, he did. I mean, he took away Nebuchadnezzar's reason. I mean, it wasn't like that happened of his own, the own workings or anything natural that we would say. He made him think that, you know, he was a cow. And then at the right time, he gave his reason back to him. That was totally controlled by God. There was nothing Nebuchadnezzar was going to do about that. Just as one other example, we have this interesting case of Ahithophel and Absalom. You know, going back to 2 Kings, reading in chapter 15, verses 31. Now someone told David, okay, and this is at the time when, you know, opposition is building, betrayal is building and so forth with Absalom. Now someone told David saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, this is so interesting, a prayer he makes here, O Lord, I pray, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness. Make his counsel foolishness. Now, he was a wise man, you know, very smart and crafty, and had been somebody who David had relied on. David knew. But he knew that God could make his counsel foolish, make it something that the Lord could use to bring down the opposition. So when you get to chapter 16, verses 20 and 21, then Absalom said to Ahithophel, give your advice. Now, what shall we do? Okay, so here's exactly what David was praying about. Ahithophel said to Absalom, go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house. Then all Israel will hear that you have made yourself odious to your father. The hands of all who are with you will also be strengthened. Great advice, you know. Go in and commit adultery in a blatant manner, and then this will really help the cause. Okay. That didn't turn out to be great advice. But we go to 17:14. Then Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel, for the Lord had ordained to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring calamity on Absalom. So here's the Lord's coming in even a different way and making them go for the counsel of another person at this point. God used foolish counsel even from Ahithophel before. Now in this situation, Ahithophel had given better counsel, and God overrules that and makes them go for the counsel of the other guy, which is totally leading them off. Okay? It's just very interesting. And what do we read in 17:23? Now when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey, arose, and went to his home, to his city, and set his house in order and strangled himself. And then he died and was buried. You know, he knew now, you know, the way things were going. He knew that he'd gotten on the wrong side and that God had worked in such a way that he was, you know, Absalom was going down and he was going down. He might as well just, you know, it's kind of the, here's a pistol, go in the office and do the right thing. He went and strangled himself. So in all of this, it was David who had the right perspective on what God was able to do and what he does do. God can cause people to give bad or good counsel, and then he can cause the hearers to follow good or bad counsel. We're not in control of such situations like we think. We're not in control of, you know, our minds being able to come to the right decision. How humbling is that? I mean, that's very humbling to me. You know, that as I'm not walking with the Lord, he can cause me to make foolish decisions. Decisions that in another context I would say, why are you doing that? Or that was dumb or whatever. And certainly we found ourselves doing that, right? Well, you know, that was just stupid thinking that. But the Lord is in charge of such things. And with this kind of wisdom, Job was in a better position than his friends to wrestle with God, you know, in regard to a purpose for his suffering. And Job can rightly say at the beginning of the next chapter, verses 1 and 2 of 13, "Behold, my eye has seen all this, my ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you." He certainly was not. Well, this greater wisdom that Job had is coming through in chapters 11 and 12. It certainly came through in chapters 13 and 14, which we've already dealt with. So, you know, we can kind of see that this was a preview to, you know, I'm in a better position to really deal with what God is doing than you are stuck in your wrong view. In the midst of his pain, we saw that Job made some amazing statements about God, about what he was going to do, about being able to trust in what God was going to do. There's some flailing around to be sure, but Job is making some solid contact with the truth as opposed to his friends. And these chapters were especially pertinent for us, you know, as we went through the season of remembering the death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus. Remember, though he slay me, I will hope in him. Okay, that came from Job. That was a great thought as we were on Palm Sunday and looking to the garden experience, the crucifixion of Christ. And then if a man dies, will he live again? You know, I will wait until my change comes. That was very helpful on Resurrection Sunday. We don't get wisdom like that from Job's three friends. That comes from the guy who was supposedly just so terribly out of order. But those who have been humbled, as Job had been, will be lifted up to see reasons for hope. Well, let's pray. Lord, we thank you that we do have your word to consult. We don't have to get creative and, you know, try to figure out why you might be giving us certain trials. I mean, obviously there is some wondering in the details, but we know from your word that you are doing something good. You are doing something of spiritual benefit for us and others. You're doing something of eternal benefit. So may we trust in what you have so graciously revealed. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.